Scotia. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two newly recorded author interviews for you today. The first is with the author of a very intriguing book called The Crucial Years, which talks about that period sometimes known as middle childhood in a youngster's development. Part two features a conversation with a journalist for The Hollywood Reporter talking about his new novel called In Pursuit of Beauty. Here's part one of today's program. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about a phase of human development that tends to be neglected, the years between ages 6 and 12, which are known as middle childhood. For whatever reason, when you look at the books that are written or the lectures that are delivered, we tend to focus much more on infancy and early childhood and on adolescence, but the so-called years of middle childhood tend to receive less attention, and that can be a problem because they are important years. They are, in fact, crucial years in which children develop in really important ways, and these are also years in which parents still retain a significant degree of influence over their children, influence which almost invariably recedes as their children grow into adolescence and other influences begin to have more powerful sway, if you will. One of the ways in which one can learn more about the importance of middle childhood in these particular years, particularly if one is a parent, is with a new book called The Crucial Years: The Essential Guide to Mental Health and Modern Puberty in Middle Childhood. This book, published by HarperCollins, is by Dr. Cheryl Gonzalez Ziegler, who has been working with youngsters for more than 20 years in the field of children's mental health. Her own personal background is quite an interesting one, and her life includes not only her professional work, but also the reality of being a mother to three children, at least one of which is in the so-called middle childhood years. She is an outstanding expert who has been featured on the Today Show, CNN Headline News, and many other places, interviewed by the New York Times, Washington Post, and many, many other places. The author of a previous book called Mommy Burnout: How to Reclaim Your Life and Raise Healthier Children. This newest book, again, called The Crucial Years: The Essential Guide to Mental Health and Modern Puberty in Middle Childhood. Dr. Cheryl Gonzalez Ziegler, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. That was quite the introduction. Thank you for doing your work.
I have enjoyed exploring this book, and I have to maybe just add parenthetically, although our listeners are well aware of this, I happen not to be a parent. Never have been a parent, never will be a parent, and yet I found this book really, really interesting and intriguing and helpful. And I think you mentioned at one point that although I would suspect your book is primarily conceived with parents in mind, you mentioned that others who are involved in the lives of children, including teachers and mentors and coaches and so on, all could very much benefit from exploring what you have written here.
I do really feel that way. And what's so interesting is you're probably, I don't know, maybe the fifth person or so, and particularly actually probably the fifth male who's interviewed me who has said, I don't have children myself, and I found this book interesting, and I found myself thinking about all sorts of things, whether it was my own childhood or my nieces, my nephews. And so that's been actually a really great surprise. But I do agree. I think if you have any part of a child's life as an educator, a coach, you know, a family member, I actually really do think this book is really eye-opening and can be so helpful in just relating to and understanding kids, or understanding also, like, where is the world at right now and where are we headed? I think there's a lot of answers that lie within this book.
I wish we had time to explore this in more detail. We really don't, but I want to give you an opportunity to touch at least briefly on your own background. I mean, you take the time to talk about it in your book. As you mentioned, the experience of reflecting back on your own middle childhood years. Summarize for our listeners your own background, the kind of family in which you grew up.
Yeah, so right before my middle childhood, I try to focus on that in the book, but what I do is I first just share who I am. So I am a daughter of a teenage single mom immigrant from Cuba. So she immigrated at the end of her crucial years around age 12 and then got pregnant with me at age 16. And I was born in Harlem and raised in New York City. And when we moved, so then my mom got married, we moved, and that's really where, from about the ages of, you know, 7 to 12, most of my crucial years, I went through a divorce. I went from my mom wound up getting a divorce when I was around 12 or 13. I also went from being an only child. We had a one-bedroom apartment, very poor, raised on welfare and food stamps, and went from being an only child sharing a bed with my mom to then being the youngest of five in upstate, we call it, an hour north of New York City, New York, where I really learned I didn't know what I was doing. I knew that I had to do something, but I was really assimilating. So I didn't even know the language really fully. I spoke Spanish. And so when I went up there, I went from being, you know, who I was truly culturally and surrounded by a lot of family to then really feeling so different and feeling like, oh my gosh, I quickly have to change who I am so that I can fit in, which now I know we call assimilation, but I didn't know what I was doing at the time. And I actually assimilated very well. Like, it was a survival technique that I had to use. And so I think that, you know, that really, really brief overview of what my middle childhood was like when I was 13. So when I was 12, my mom got pregnant with my sibling, my brother. And so I then also went through that. I went through a lot. And when I share my story, other people do too. Like, we really remember our teen years very well. Our childhood, we have lots of highlights, 0 to 5, right? Baby to toddler. We don't really remember. We hear stories. We see pictures. But this time in my life, I can even see, even without having done the research, how much it impacted who I am, what I do, what my purpose is, and how I can relate and connect with so many different types of people. So there's a little overview of me.
Very good. So one of the things that prompts you to write this book is the fact that you are seeing such a prevalence of mental health issues in young people. And in many cases, we are talking about outright depression, anxiety issues, and so on. That actually begin to formulate during these years. And it sounds like one of the tricky matters when it comes to, for instance, parents, is that they often are reluctant to venture into some of these areas, into some of these topics, as though that's something that you have to wait till they become teenagers, and that's when you start talking about some of these emotional issues and so on. And one of the things you suggest in the book is that it isn't possible, it isn't prudent, it isn't wise to wait, that some of these really serious matters do need to be at least acknowledged during these so-called middle childhood years, that preserving the untouched innocence of our children is not the best way to serve them. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, and I want to, for somebody listening who, you know, hasn't read the book, I want to paint a picture of what that looks like, exactly what you're saying, because what happens is, I understand issues like depression or suicide or body image issues, let's say, those are issues parents, they don't want to touch them. And oftentimes we all have sort of our unresolved issues ourselves around these things that we may never have talked about. It usually is sort of familial. It gets passed down how we communicate. Are we open? You know, you'll meet a family and they'll say, oh, they'll laugh and say, in our family, we talk about everything, and they chuckle. Or you meet, you know, a family and maybe they don't say, hey, we don't talk about anything, but you can get the feeling of like, oh, okay, in this family, we don't talk or joke about, you know, these certain things. So every family has that flavor to them. And so what I would really say is, when I say, let's say, you're going to talk to a 6 or 7 year old about something potentially like depression or anxiety, you don't have to use clinical terms or scare them at all. You can say things like, hey, we have moods, right? And that's sort of how we feel. Some days we feel happy, some days we feel sad, some days we're confused. And just that simple little conversation, like, hey, so what's your mood feeling like right now? Or how does your mood feel after school? And your kid then, all of a sudden, they start to gain this emotional vocabulary. And they'll start saying, oh, well, today I was surprised. Oh, you were surprised about something. So you give them just a space to talk about their day, but not just transactional. I went to lunch, I played with so-and-so at recess, and then I went to soccer. You know, that's transactional conversations. In the book, I really emphasize communication, because just like you said, 6 to 12 is when we lay the foundation for how do we communicate as a family? How do we deal with problems? How do we like protect problem solving? And so you do it that way. And then eventually they become 8 and 9 and 10, and maybe you really start to see something that is concerning. Because again, let's say depression in a kid often looks like irritability. So then you might say, I've been noticing now, it's been a couple of weeks, and it seems like you get frustrated easily at home. You know, you give some examples, and now they've already got a couple of years under their belt. They're used to talking like this. They are so much more likely to engage in that kind of conversation with you, rather than if you've never talked about feelings or emotions or real experiences, and then you all of a sudden do it, it's very uncomfortable. They're more likely to shut down. So I just want people to understand, at these young ages, it starts just with open communication, and then eventually you start leading into, you know, even puberty. Hey, you know, do you realize our bodies are going to change, and you're going to grow taller, and your hips are going to grow wider, and, you know, you start saying these things. And when you do that, all of a sudden, even those conversations about the physical changes that happen in middle childhood during puberty, they're just normalized. It's not awkward, because you've been talking this way for years. It's all they know. And so anybody who you've ever met, if anyone can think of somebody, or if it's even you, who had a family who was like that, they literally will just laugh and say, oh my gosh, growing up in my family, we talked about everything. Nothing was off the table. And that's all they knew. So that's the way they are. And sometimes they'll say, oh, it wasn't until I went to a friend's house or I got married that I realized that not every family talks like this. I didn't know any different. So that's just the way that it could look. It doesn't have to be scary or awkward.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Cheryl Gonzalez-Ziegler about her book, The Crucial Years, The Essential Guide to Mental Health and Modern Puberty in Middle Childhood. I want to make sure that listeners understand how you have organized each chapter of the book. And each of them involve, in one way or another, a certain paradigm shift. It's such an intriguing way to give this book a framework. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, thank you so much for noticing that. There is a consistent structure for all of the chapters in the book. There's 9 chapters in the book. And so the first thing I do pretty early on, well, I set the chapter based upon a real client experience that I've had, a real family child that I've worked with, of course. Besides changing the, you know, details to protect their privacy, the story comes from a real origin that I've treated. And so I kind of lay that out, right? I might open a chapter and say, oh, Ava was 9 years old. Her parents brought her in. This were the issues. Then pretty early on, I have something called a paradigm shift. And what I basically, and there's just 2 parts of it. It's a little box. And the first thing says paradigm. And that's sort of how we're thinking about things today. And then, and it's, you know, 2 sentences at most. And then The next one is the shift. And that's the shift that I think we need to have because of the way that things are changing, whether that's because of technology or screens or mental health issues or earlier puberty. So then I'll have the shift. So, hey, we're thinking about it this way, but here's how I have to, I think we need to shift. So, and then I go through and I talk about, you know, whatever the topic is of the chapter. And lots of people have said this book is like your resource guide, truly. You could have it on your nightstand or on a bookshelf handy, and you can read the whole thing cover to cover, or you can just flip to certain sections because I have scripts. So almost every chapter has multiple scripts, usually on, you know, how to talk to your kid about, and then it'll give you examples. And then I kind of end with two things. I end with a looking ahead, which is, hey, this sweet child of yours is going to be a teenager, right? Because I work with tweens and teens, so I love teens too. So I'll do a little looking ahead. Looking ahead, if you have this conversation or do this thing with your kid at 8 and 9 and 10, let's say talking about screens, setting good boundaries with, around screen time and monitoring it, when they are 14, 15, 16, here's a challenge that's probably going to happen, and here's how I think it's going to go better because you did the thing. You did the work these 6 years. And then I have, and then I end it with in a nutshell so I can give everybody a really quick overview of what the chapter, what I thought the chapter highlights were. So thanks for noticing the structure. We did do it that way on purpose.
I think it works out really, really well. One of the things you acknowledge in the book, and I think it's really important to say this, is that it's a different world. I mean, it's the same planet, but it's a different world. It's a different life that we are living now versus when you experienced middle childhood, and certainly when I experienced middle childhood 1,000 years ago. And one of the things that has changed, and you just mentioned it, is this presence of screens and how the way in which our young people occupy their time, much of that time is often spent in front of a screen. And you take the time to talk about the ways in which this can affect a child, and not just beyond the fact that, you know, they maybe don't get enough exercise then or aren't spending enough time in their homework or whatever, but there are other ways in which their emotional and mental development can be badly hindered by too much time in front of a screen. Just mention one or two of the most important ways in which this can be really detrimental to the development of a young person.
Yeah, I mean, I think to get grounded, too, and how prevalent this is, I talk about Chapter 8 is about shaping healthier digital habits. I tried to make it positive because there's so much negative here. But I think to get us grounded, there's a couple of things. First, kids have their first smartphone by age of 10. So on average, that's the average age a kid in this country gets a smartphone. And by the age of 12, three-quarters of them have one. So between, you know, the ages of probably 8 to 12, 3 out of 4 kids are going to have a smartphone. And so what that does in terms of what you're saying, rewiring the brain, this is like the great rewiring of childhood. It impacts kids in terms of, like you said, you know, they play less, they are more sedentary, they're not moving around as much, we have higher obesity rates. We're seeing ADHD diagnoses on the rise. Their attention is now really shortened, so they get bored pretty easily. And so when you talk about the great rewiring of the brain, what that means is, I'm sure people have heard, you're watching either quick shows on YouTube, YouTube Shorts, they're watching TikTok, whatever it is they're watching. Those are short and very fast snippets. If you've ever watched them, they talk fast, they move fast. And so what's happening is when that child goes into a classroom to try to learn in a slower, more methodical kind of way, they get very bored. And so they aren't learning the same way. Teachers are having to figure out how to teach in different ways. And what we see is the more screen time there is, the higher the potential for depression and anxiety and poor self-image is. So if the ages of 6 to 12 are what we call industry versus inferiority. That's the psychosocial stage of development. At the end, you either feel inferior, which means you have low self-esteem, you don't really know what you're good at, or you're going to feel competent. You're going to feel industrious, which means, hey, I know what I'm good at. And right now, I'm about to go into my identity years of the teenage years knowing that I'm a competent person. I know what I'm good at, so I can find my people and identify with who I really am. So when you have this increased screen time and you have the potential to not feel great about yourself, compare yourself versus others, be engaged in these group chats where you're saying and doing things you would never do in person. You're spending less time with people, IRL, like they would call it, in real life. This is really causing loneliness, isolation. Even kids are dating less. There are stats that say, oh, this is so great. Teenage pregnancy is down. And in some ways, you can laugh and say, well, teenage pregnancy is down because they actually spend less time together in real life. Their idea sometimes of hanging out is for boys and girls, really, playing video games or social video games. And so it's impacting their every single bit of life, like academically, socially, and emotionally. I could go on and on about it, but it's really significant. So that's a huge takeaway for parents is if you feel like, oh, I think these should be easier years, I can lay back a little bit. They're not teenagers yet. You're going to be surprised that A, they're going to feel like teenagers earlier, and B, their lives are so incredibly different from ours that there's not even a comparison because we just didn't have these things when we were kids.
Right. And of course, your book offers parents and others some thoughts on how this can be managed and in a way that, you know, your kids aren't going to just kind of hate you or resent you or be perpetually frustrated as you, you know, try to set up barricades that prevent them from doing what they might want to do. There are ways to do this that are not quite as oppressive, and I appreciate the way that you go about doing this. I want to make sure that we touch on one matter that is even in the subtitle of the book, and that is the fact that puberty now seems to be beginning earlier than it once did. I mean, compared to, for instance, 50 years ago, it's beginning in many cases a year earlier than we used to see. And apparently this is something that we do not yet fully understand, although your book shares some theories on what might possibly be going on. But more to the point, it's here. I mean, this is a reality. Why is it important for parents to be aware of this, or how is it helpful for a parent to be aware of this particular reality, that puberty might come sooner rather than later for their child?
Yeah, I mean, I think just painting the broad strokes, parents need to understand girls are starting puberty earlier. And we're talking, if we look at the early 1900s, let's say, compared to then, we're at 5 years earlier than the 1900s.
Wow.
And from, yeah, it's striking. And it makes sense, actually, if you look at psychological research and what we thought was happening in these stages, you can see it reflected then. If puberty wasn't happening, then Freud was closer to saying, okay, he said he called this stage latency. So he thought, oh, this is a time where things are quiet. So why is this important if we're comparing to the 1900s? Does that matter? It actually does, because our systems are set up as if childhood is childhood and adolescence is something that's more like 12 and 13 and up. And so when we look at the 1980s, puberty has dropped 3 months per decade since the 80s, and it's continuing to trend that way. And why does that matter? It matters for parents because we have kids who have two major things happening now at the same time versus in different stages. So middle childhood, you have a kid 6 to 12. They're going to school for the first time. They're gaining some independence and autonomy. And they are truly, their job is to figure out what are they good at, independent of mom and dad. What can they do all on their own? That's why they love, it starts in toddlers, but they love saying, like, I can do that. No, I can get that, right? That's very important to development. And so that used to be, they had 6 years to really figure that out. Now all of a sudden, we've got kids. If you had a girl at age 8 starting puberty and a boy at age 9 starting puberty, that would be considered early, but not. It's not a reason to go to the doctor. It's still within the average range. The average range is like 8 to 11 and 9 to 12. So we have kids who are, you know, I'm using the word puberty. Puberty is sexual development. So that means it starts in the brain, That's where you're going to see moods. You're going to see mood swings. You're going to see wild emotions. You're going to see dysregulation. You're going to see that now in 8, 9, and 10-year-olds where you were not expecting that. At the very most, parents were expecting that maybe in middle school. And even in middle school, they'll be like, oh, I thought that this happened just in high school. But no, it's now happening in third and fourth grade. And so that's very important for a parent to understand, because otherwise they're thinking, what is wrong with my kid? Why are they having these toddler tantrums, but their bodies are getting bigger? Why are they so moody? Why do they act like a teenager? And we know now it's because puberty starts in the brain. So before you even see the physical change of puberty, you're going to see probably some mood swings. And again, that can be happening at 8 and 9 years old, and that would be considered within the norm.
It's all kind of wild, and at one point you describe as the often confusing terrain of middle childhood. It can be intimidating for parents, and especially in a landscape in which we do not have nearly enough mental health practitioners working with young people. So in a sense, more responsibility falls on the shoulders of parents, but it is exactly books like this that help parents to see these years as more than anything an opportunity to make a difference for the better in their lives of their own children. The book is The Crucial Years, The Essential Guide to Mental Health and Modern Puberty in Middle Childhood, published by HarperCollins, the author, Dr. Cheryl Gonzalez-Ziegler. Dr. Gonzalez-Ziegler, I really did enjoy this book. I found it fascinating, and I know many people will be tremendously helped by it. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for joining me on the morning show today to talk about it.
Thank you so much for reading it and for the kind words and the great interview. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm excited to be able to speak for the next few minutes with an award-winning investigative journalist at The Hollywood Reporter. His name is Gary Baum. And he is not only responsible for a lot of interesting articles for The Hollywood Reporter, but also responsible for a debut novel that has just been published called In Pursuit of Beauty, which in many respects springs out of the work that he does as a journalist, particularly in the realms of entertainment, especially as it plays out in the glitzy city of Hollywood. And the ways in which celebrities play with fact versus fiction in all kinds of intriguing and sometimes self-destructive ways, that figures as well in this novel, again, called In Pursuit of Beauty. And I'm excited to be able to speak with Gary Baum for the next few minutes about it and about his work as a reporter. Gary Baum, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Greg, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Could we begin by hearing a little bit about how you found yourself on this particular beat, that is, the work that you have done for The Hollywood Reporter? Is that something right from the start that you sort of set out to do, or is this an opportunity that sort of crossed your path a bit by accident, maybe a little of both? Explain how you are, who you are professionally.
I've been working in journalism for 20 years, and I'm from Los Angeles originally. So for me, working at The Hollywood Reporter, which is a business publication that covers the film and television industries, is sort of like working at the hometown paper. I worked at another city magazine earlier in my career, and about 14 years ago, I came over to The Hollywood Reporter. And, my beat is really investigations and looking at various ways that power expresses itself, and sometimes systems fail and people get in trouble or cause trouble for other people, and look at sort of the carapace and structures that surround the entertainment industry and make it function, and kind of how it interacts with the rest of the city and also sort of the larger culture. And so it's a really interesting beat, and kind of a wide and sort of amorphous one.
I wonder if you would venture a guess as to what the single most significant misunderstanding is that the rest of us who are not part of your world have about kind of the upper echelons of the entertainment industry, and especially as it plays out in Hollywood, what we sort of imagine that city and that landscape to be versus what it really is. And you, of course, can speak as somebody who is very much a part of it.
I think that behind the glitter is the grit, and behind the glamour is a certain everyday quality. For people who live and work in Los Angeles and in this sort of space that is Hollywood, you know, it is a place and a space that is, it's a function of, you know, it's a company town, and it's a business like any business, an automotive industry, a tech industry, manufacturing, agriculture, and oftentimes it's about the bottom line. It's about budgets. It's about what can be done, the politics of the possible, things like that. And the, well, what makes, you know, so much of it, the vast majority of it, is really no different than anywhere else in America. But the thing that might be different about it, and I think it's part of what animates the work that I do, is that, you know, because it's so many people that work in this space, whether they work on the creative part of it or they work on the more financial part of it, are doing, you know, they came here to Hollywood, again, to both the business of it and the physical place of it, because they wanted to make a living and pursue passion that is fundamentally in some way not sensical. And it creates a space of what I think of as sort of like illusions and delusions that are a little bit broader than what you might find elsewhere. Wallace Stegner has a line about how California is America, only more so. And I think that that's even more true of Los Angeles. It's sort of an extremist.
In a really interesting article that you wrote for People magazine early in June, there was a great line that I think is worth our talking about for just a moment. And I think it's apropos, or I mean in the sense that it's adjacent to what your novel In Pursuit of Beauty explores. At one point in talking about your work with The Hollywood Reporter, you say your work is so much about navigating fictions. And you go on to say that sometimes those fictions are intentional and sometimes rather unintentional. But it's really interesting to think about how challenging it is to do work that involves navigating fictions. Tell us more.
Yeah, you know, I think that when you're talking to people at length and in depth, and it's not just about people having something to promote, but people oftentimes talking to you in an ambivalent fashion or about something that is troubling them, or maybe they are the ones that cause that trouble in the universe. They have a narrative, they have a story, and it's something that they hold dear to. It's their point of view. It's, you know, they're the main character of their life. And when you're a journalist exerting pressure on that, you know, that's where obviously the dynamic occurs, right? And sometimes some sort of factual truth comes out of that. And sometimes an emotional truth comes out of that, but that's not necessarily the same thing. I think that something I've learned over the years in journalism is that there's definitely, you know, many, many things can be true at once, and many people can have many truths that they hold at once, and truths can come in conflict with each other, but that doesn't mean any of them are necessarily false.
And you get to make sense of all that as a reporter. I don't envy. I mean, I mostly don't envy that you in terms of the challenge of that. Although I should think it is also probably a sort of delicious, satisfying challenge to be able to navigate that successfully. One other line in that article, and we've been sort of dancing around this same point, and I don't remember if this is your line or somebody you quoted in that People magazine article, but the line is, people increasingly think of themselves as fictions. And you go on to say that it means, and it, you go on to say that sort of changes the equation when it comes to us reading fiction, or the way that we use fiction to make sense of the world and of our place in it. Explain what you're getting at there.
Well, you know, even in the time that I've worked professionally talking to people in the last couple of decades, I've noticed this shift. I think it's part of a larger thing, particularly among younger people, that, you know, the way that people conceive of themselves is, and understand themselves is often more malleable, even into adulthood. And this might be something more specific to the area that I cover here in Los Angeles, but that there's more flexibility and that there's more self-narration, and that in an environment, in a period, in an era where that is the case, that, you know, I think that both journalists and novelists, fiction writers, and other dramatists, you know, it means that you have to alter or adjust your approach to understanding how people think about themselves. And you need to change your aperture. And obviously that's kind of, that brought me into, you know, my desire to turn to this novel, and even how I structured this novel, which is about a journalist's pursuit of a particularly challenging subject. Who has their own very specific view of the world. And I think that, you know, people's ideas of them, that gets back at the point we were talking about before about narrative, and that I think that as the idea of fact and sort of truth has sort of eroded over the last couple of decades, and it's become something that's been atomized and taken on as a on people's personal terms, which is unfortunate in the sort of civic level. On this sort of personal space, it also alters how we think about our consciousness, and I think that's a space that creates richness for a novelist to work in.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Gary Baum, and he is a reporter for The Hollywood Reporter, and he is also now a published novelist. His debut novel called In Pursuit of Beauty. Let's have you first describe this Beverly Hills plastic surgeon who is right at the heart of this story. And the success that she has enjoyed, but the way in which so much of her life and career has crumbled.
Yeah, so this character, Dr. Roya Delshad, she's a plastic surgeon in Beverly Hills who grew up in Beverly Hills in a particular strata, a class and racial strata that's specific to Beverly Hills, the city, she's a sort of an emotional and cultural and sociological product of that place and her time. And eventually what happens in the sort of the fulcrum of the book and the structure of the book is that she ends up engaging in a bit of a Robin Hood activity where she miscodes procedures at her private practice so that she can give some patients procedures that they can't afford with their public and private insurance plans. And she ends up losing her medical license and having to serve a shortish term in prison for this, because it happened at a certain volume. And she ends up feeling the need to tell her story of why and what happened. A journalist somewhat like myself, not exactly like myself, wants to tell the story of her story, which kind of had gone viral, and seeks to profile her for National Magazine. And she is resistant, but she eventually convinces him to be her ghostwriter. And so, you know, half the book in alternating chapters is the memoir that he ends up writing for her, and the other half is their sort of fraught back and forth from his point of view of how that relationship develops. And it's a bit of an intellectual thriller.
And I think that sort of interesting tug of war is absolutely fascinating and really, really well handled. The very first words that we read in the novel brought a lot of things to my mind, and these are the words of the plastic surgeon, the aforementioned plastic surgeon who now is in such trouble. Here's what she says. Surface matters. It's not merely what's inside that counts. The superficial is full of meaning and consequence. My life's work is evidence. My life, the proof. I'm reminded of a really hilarious line from the sitcom Third Rock from the Sun, when the character of Harry, when all the characters at the end of this particular episode are talking about, you know, the lessons they've learned as they kind of sit out on the up on the sort of the upper level of their house, and Harry says to his friends, "I learned that you can judge a book by its cover, because that's what it's for, to tell you what's inside the book." And so, and of course, exactly the opposite of what everybody else teaches us, that don't judge a book by its cover. But yes, you can judge a book by its cover. And that's not exactly what this plastic surgeon is getting at. But it is really interesting to think about this way of thinking about the surface and about thinking of that as something that really, truly matters. Is that a common perspective in Hollywood? I'm guessing that it is, and maybe it's a common perspective everywhere.
I mean, look, it's a business about images, right? And it's a business in which images need to be marketed, the body and the face is central to storytelling, and I think that for Roya, this protagonist, you know, she's somebody that believes in a certain set of social science that says that looks has, you know, a very determinate place in outcomes and social outcomes, how we are treated by others, what we get in our romantic prospects, in our business prospects, in just how things go. And it's not a fair thing unless, in her mind, there should be, you know, what she calls beauty reparations. You know, when she creates a whole system to sort of justify what she did and why it should actually go further. And she kind of creates this almost a sort of a radicalized plan for what she believes should justify the playing field, because she's both a sort of an idealist and also just a little bit half-cocked there.
Well, this reporter whom she engages to try to write this self-serving autobiography of sorts, we hear from him at the top of chapter one as he describes the way in which he specializes in what he calls one of the dark arts of journalism. And he says, when you do this kind of thing for a living, you see the news cycle as a cavalcade of potential marks They mostly fall into a few categories. There are the nobodies, for who whatever reason have become somebodies, not my thing. There are the nobodies suffering forever as nobodies, worthy work, also not my thing. There are the somebodies who are on a certain slide toward becoming nobodies, perhaps already most of the way there, a perennial interest. There are the somebodies at the top of their game, dull and often irritating assignments, but pays the bills. And there are the somebodies who've fallen out of favor, experienced some loss, yet are angling to reclaim their forfeited status. These are my favorite. I wonder if this has ever been a part of your work as a journalist in Hollywood, or is this something you've mostly observed from afar?
I'd say both. Wes, this journalist turned ghostwriter, is not me, but he's got some of me in him. He's sort of a composite character of people I know, but I would say that I'm certainly sympathetic and understanding of what he says there. If you have the opportunity in journalism to kind of pick your assignments, so to speak, and locate your focus of subjects, there are those sort of different baskets of people to focus on, and to a certain extent the news cycle determines it, and to a certain extent if you're good at what you do, are able to make news out of kind of anybody. People have different tastes in these things, but I think that what he's getting at there is people that, you know, understandably undergone some sort of loss, as we all in life end up doing, and experience some sort of vulnerability or setback, and have just probably gone through conflict, are the ones that have a richer story to tell and might have a different kind of engagement than somebody who is, I think, as you said, kind of at the top of their game.
Mm. Well, what ensues is a really crazy journey, a crazy ride, and it's written so vividly, so brilliantly. And I do also appreciate the moments in this novel when you have these characters reflecting very thoughtfully on who they are and what their lives amount to. And this proved to be a book far more thought-provoking than I really honestly expected it to be, In Pursuit of Beauty. And it's published by Blackstone and the author, Gary Baum. Gary Baum, I really enjoyed your book, and I enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you about it and about your work. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you for such a wonderful discussion. I really appreciate it.
Next week on The Morning Show, some interesting conversations, beginning with Monday's program, Lisa Skinner, the author of Truth, Lies, and Alzheimer's, Its Secret Faces. She has worked with Alzheimer's patients for many, many years. On Tuesday, a couple of interviews, including one with Paul Rogers, who is founder and president of the Milwaukee Air and Water Show, and this year's air show is coming up next weekend. On Wednesday, a conversation about some of the things you can do in Door County. On Thursday, we preview the next Racine Theatre Guild production. It's the musical The Drowsy Chaperone. And a week from today, a treasure from the archives, a conversation I recorded back in 2007 with author S.C. Hinton, S.E. Hinton, responsible for the classic young adult novel The Outsiders, which is now a Tony Award-winning musical. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You find the program archived on our website, WGTD.org, and you can also hear the program in podcast format 7 days a week. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Variable cloudiness today with a 50% chance of intermittent rain and a high today of 87 degrees. Cloudy, warm, and rainy overnight. Overnight low of 73. Cloudy tomorrow and a 50% chance of rain, a high of 85 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and